"Tell me more of yourself," she whispered. "I want to know everything about you, my lord."
"Call me not so. My name is Kevin."
"Kevin," she said,
and made her voice soft and tender, just brushing her fingers again over his arm. Day by day she wove her spell, with touches and glances and whispered words, as the moon waned away toward darkness. After that first swift kiss, she withdrew again, as if he had frightened her.
"It is true, but it is more that I frighten myself."
Never, never in all the years of seclusion had she suspected herself of being capable of such passion, such hunger. And she knew that her spells were enhancing it in herself as in him. At one point, teased beyond endurance by her whispered touches, the soft brushing of her hair against his face when she bent over him where he sat at his harp, he turned and seized her and crushed her to him. And she struggled in real fright this time.
"No, no, I cannot. You forget yourself. I beg you, let me go," she cried out.
And when he only clasped her closer, burying his face in her bosom and covering her breasts with kisses, she began to cry softly.
"No, no, I'm afraid. I'm afraid."
He let her go then, and drew away almost in a daze. His breath was hoarse and hard. He sat with his eyes closed, his twisted hands hanging limp. After a moment he murmured, "My beloved, my precious white bird, my own sweetheart, forgive me, forgive me." Nimue realized that now she could use even her own very real fear for her own ends. She said, whimpering,
"I trusted you. I trusted you."
"You should not," he said hoarsely. "I am no more than a man, and certainly not less than one." And she cringed at the bitterness as he added, "I am a man of flesh and blood, and I love you, Nimue, and you play with me as if I were a lapdog, and expect me to be tame as a gelded pony. Do you think because I am a cripple I am less than a man?" In his mind, Nimue could see, clear and mirrored, memory of a time when he had said this to the first woman who had ever come to him, and saw Morgaine reflected in his eyes and his mind. Not the Morgaine she knew, but a dark, bewitching woman, soft of voice, yet somehow terrible, too, worshipped, and also feared, because through the days of passion he could remember that suddenly the lightning would strike. Nimue reached her hands to him, and knew they were trembling, and that he would never know why. She guarded her thoughts carefully and said,
"I never thought that. Forgive me, Kevin. I could not help myself."
"And it is all true, goddess. It is all true. But not as he believes. What I say is not what he hears." And yet, for all her pity and desire, there was a thread of contempt, too. "Otherwise I could not bear it to do what I do. But a man so nakedly at the mercy of desire is contemptible. I too tremble. I am torn. But I will not be at the mercy of my body's hunger." And that was why Morgaine had given her the key to this man, put him wholly into her hands. Now was the time to speak the words that would consolidate the spell, make him hers, body and soul, so that she might bring him to Avalon and the appointed doom.
"Pretend.
Pretend to be one of those feckless virgins Guinevere has about her, with their minds between their legs." She said, faltering,
"I'm sorry. I know you are indeed a man. I'm sorry I was afraid."
And she raised her eyes to his, a gaze aslant through her long hair, afraid that if he could look deep into her eyes, she would blurt out all her duplicity.
Yes, I wanted you to kiss me. But then you were so fierce, and I was frightened. This is neither the time nor the place. Someone might come suddenly upon us, and then the Queen would be angry, and I am one of her maidens, and she has warned us that we mustn't run about with men.
Is he fool enough to believe me when I speak such simpering nonsense? My poor darling. Kevin covered her hands with contrite kisses. Oh, I'm a beast to frighten you. I love you so. I love you so much that I cannot bear it. Nimue, Nimue, are you so afraid of the Queen's anger? I cannot... He stopped and breathed again, hard. I cannot live like this. Would you have it that I should be gone from this court? Never, never have I... He stopped again, and then, holding her hands between his, he said, I cannot live without you. I must have you or die. Will you not have some pity on me, beloved? She lowered her eyes with a long sigh, watching his contorted face, his dazed breathing. At last she whispered,
What can I say to you?
Say that you love me.
I love you.
She knew that she sounded like a woman under a spell.
You know that I do.
Say that you will give me all your love. Say that.
Oh, Nimue, Nimue,
you are so young and beautiful, and I'm so twisted and ugly. I cannot believe you care for me. Even now I think I'm dreaming, that you have for some reason roused me like this, that you might make fun of the beast grovelling at your feet like a dog.
No,
she said, and swiftly, as if she were afraid of her own daring, bent quickly down and laid the lightest of kisses against his eyes, two darting swallows that came and went. Nimue, will you come to my bed? She whispered,
I'm frightened. We might be seen. And I dare not be so wanton. We might be discovered.
She arranged her lips into a childish pout.
If we were caught, then the men would think you only all the more manly for it, and none would chide or shame you. But I'm a maiden, and they would point to me as a harlot, or worse.
And she let tears slide down her cheek, but inward she was all triumph.
I have him now safe within my net.
I would do anything, anything to protect you, to reassure you, Kevin said, his voice trembling with sincerity.
I know men like to boast of their conquest of maidens, she said. How do I know you will not brag of it throughout Camelot, that you have the favour of the Queen's kinswoman, and have taken her maidenhood?
Trust me. I beg you, trust me. What can I do? What proof can I give you of my sincerity? You know that I am yours, body and heart and soul. And for a moment she was angry.
I don't want your damned soul, she thought, close to weeping with tension and fear.
He held her between his hands and whispered,
How?
When will you be mine? What can I do to prove that I love you beyond all things?
She said, hesitating, I cannot take you to my bed. I sleep in a room with four of the Queen's ladies, and any man who came there would be seized by the guards.
He said, bending again to cover her hands with kisses, My poor little love, I would never bring shame on you. I have a place of my own, a little chamber fit for a dog, mostly because none other of the king's men wishes to share quarters with me. I do not know if you would dare to come there.
Surely there must be some better way, she whispered, keeping her voice soft and tender.
Damn you, how can I suggest it without dropping this pretense of maidenly innocence and stupidity?
I cannot think of anywhere within the castle where we could be truly safe, and yet...
She stood and pressed herself against him, where he sat, her breasts just nudging his brow. He flung his arms around her, and buried his face in her body, his shoulders shaking. Then he said, "At this season it is warm and fair, and there is little rain. Would you dare to come out of doors with me, Nimue?" She murmured, as artlessly as she could,
"I would dare anything to be with you, my love."
"Then tonight."
"Oh," she whispered, shrinking. "The moonlight is so bright, we should be seen. Wait a few days, then there will be no moon."
"When the moon is dark." Kevin flinched, and she knew that here was the moment of danger, the moment when the carefully played fish might slip off the hook and out of the net and be free. In Avalon, the priestesses secluded themselves at moon dark, and all magic was suspended. But he knew not that she was of Avalon. Would his fear or his desire win out? She was motionless, just fluttering her fingers within his. He said,
"That is an uncanny time."
"But I am afraid to be seen.
You do not know how angry the Queen would be with me if she knew I was such a wanton as to desire you," she said, holding herself a little closer to him.
"Surely you and I do not need a moon to see one another."
He held her tight, his face buried in her breasts, covering them with hungry kisses. And then he whispered,
"My little love, let it be as you will, be the moonlight or dark."
"And you will take me away from Camelot afterward? I do not want to be shamed."
"Anywhere," he said. "I swear it. I will swear it by your God, if you will."
She murmured, bending her head close to him, her hands moving through the sweet, clean curliness of his hair.
"The Christian God doesn't like lovers, and hates it when women lie with men. Swear it by your God, Kevin. Swear it by the serpents around your wrists."
He whispered, "I swear." And the meaning of the oath seemed to ripple the air around them both.
"Oh, fool, you have sworn to your death."
Nimue shivered, but Kevin, his face still hidden against her breasts, his hot breath damping her gown, was oblivious to anything except her breasts under his lips. As a promised lover, he took the privilege of touching, kissing, drawing her gown aside a little to cup them in his hands.
"I do not know how I can bear to wait."
And she murmured,
"No, nor I,"
and meant it with all her heart.
"I would that this was done."
The moon wouldn't be visible, but the moon tide would turn exactly 2 hours after sunset, 3 days from now. She could feel its ebbing like a great sickness in her blood, withdrawing life from her veins. Most of those 3 days she spent in her chambers, telling the Queen that she was ill, and it wasn't far from the truth. Much of her time alone she spent with her hands on Kevin's harp, meditating, filling the ether around her with the magical bond between them. An ill-omened time, and Kevin knew it, as she did, but he was too blinded by the promise of her love to care. The day dawned when the moon would darken. Nimue felt it through her body. She had made herself an herbal brew which would keep the moon-dark bleeding from coming on. She didn't want to disgust him with the sight of her blood, nor frighten him to recalling the taboos of Avalon. She had to turn her mind away from the physical realities of the act. For all her training, she knew that in truth she was the nervous virgin she pretended to be. Well, so much the better. She needn't try to pretend. She could simply be what she was, a girl giving herself for the first time to a man she loved and desired. And what would come after that? Well, it was as the goddess had bidden her. She hardly knew how to make the day pass. Never had the chatter of Guinevere's ladies seemed so meaningless, so vapid. In the afternoon she couldn't turn her mind to spinning, so she brought the harp Kevin had given her and played and sang for them. But it wasn't easy. She must avoid all the songs of Avalon, and they were the ones which she found floating in her mind. But even the longest day wears to sunset. She washed herself and scented her body, and sat near Guinevere in the hall, merely picking at her food, sick and faint, disgusted by the grossness of the table manners, the dogs under the table. She could see Kevin seated among the king's councillors near the house priest, who confessed some of the ladies. He had been bothering her, asking why she didn't seek spiritual advice, and when she said she was in no need of it, frowning as if she were the worst of sinners. Kevin, she could almost feel his hungry hands on her breast, and it seemed as if the look he sent toward her must be audible. Tonight, tonight, my beloved, tonight. Oh, goddess, how can I do this to this man who loves me, who has put his whole soul into my hands? I have sworn I must keep my oath, or be as much a traitor as he. They met for a moment in the lower hall as the queen's ladies went away to their chambers. He said swiftly and very low, "I have concealed your horse and mine in the woods beyond the gate. Afterward," and his voice shook, "afterward I will take you away wherever you will, lady."
"You do not know whither I shall lead you."
But it was too late to turn back. She said, through tears she couldn't control,
"Oh, Kevin, I love you," and knew it was true.
She had wound herself so deep in his heart that she didn't know, she couldn't even imagine how she could bear to be apart from him. It seemed to her that the whole air of the night was alive with magic, that somehow others must see this great trembling in the air and the darkness hovering over her. She must let them think she had gone abroad on some likely errand. She told the ladies who shared her chamber that she had promised one of the chamberlain's wives to try a remedy for the toothache, and that she wouldn't be back for many hours. Then, taking her darkest, heaviest cloak, and tying the small sickle of her initiation about her waist beneath her gown, she slipped out. After a moment, she turned into a dark corner and removed the little sickle, slipping it into a tied pocket at her waist. Whatever befell, Kevin mustn't see it. "His heart would break if I failed to keep this tryst," she thought. He didn't know how fortunate he would be. Darkness. Not even shadows in the moonless courtyard. She found herself trembling, picking her steps carefully by the dimmest of starlight. After a little, there was a deeper darkness, and she heard his voice, a muted, hoarse mutter. "Nimue?"
"It is I, my beloved."
"Which is the greatest falsity, to break my oath to Avalon, or to lie to Kevin thus?"
"Both are false. Is a lie ever right?"
He took her arm, and the touch of his hot hand made her own blood heat. They were both deeply entangled now in the magic of the hour. He led her outside the gate, down the steep slope that raised the ancient fort of Camelot above the surrounding hills. In winter this ran a river and swampy. Now it was dry, thick with the rank growth of the damp lands. He led her into a grove of trees.
"Oh, goddess, I always knew that on this day when I laid down my virginity, that it would be within a grove. But I didn't know it would be with all the sorcery of the dark moon."
He took her close and kissed her. His whole body seemed to be burning. He spread their cloaks together on the grass and drew her down, his twisted hand shaking so hard on the fastenings of her dress that she had to take and loosen them herself. He said, with a shred of his natural voice, "I'm glad it is dark, that my misshapen body will not terrify you."
"Nothing about you could frighten me, my love," she whispered, and reached out her hands for him.
At the moment she meant it utterly, wrapped in her own spell which had caught her too, knowing that this man, body and heart and soul, was in her hands. Yet for all her magic, she was inexperienced, and she shrank away with real fear from the touch of his hardening manhood. He kissed and soothed and caressed her, and she felt the burning of the slack tide, the thick darkening of the hour of sorcery. At the very moment when it peaked, she pulled him down to her, knowing that if she delayed until the new moon showed in the sky, she would lose much of her power. He murmured, feeling her trembling, "Nimue, Nimue, my little love, you are a maiden. If you will, we can pleasure one another, and I need not take your virginity." Something in that made her want to weep, that he, maddened by his desire, this heavy thing that twisted between them, could still so consider her. But she cried out,
"No, no, I want you,"
and pulled him down fiercely to her, taking her hands and guiding him into her, almost welcoming the sudden pain. Pain, the sudden blood, the peaking of his frenzied desire woke a like frenzy in her, and she clung to him, gasping, encouraging him with her fierce cries. And then, at the very last moment, she held him away while he gasped and pleaded, and she whispered,
"On your oath, you are mine?"
"I swear it. Oh, I cannot bear, I cannot, let me..."
"Wait. You swear it. You are mine. Say it."
I swear by my soul."
"Yet a third time. You are mine."
"I am yours, I swear." And she felt his sudden spasm of fear, knowing what had happened. But now he was in the grip of his own frenzy, moving on her as if despairing, heaving and gasping, crying out as if in unendurable agony. And she felt the magical spell descending on her at the very moment of slack tide, as he cried out and fell heavily on her unresisting body, and she felt the spurting of his seed within her. He was still as death, and she trembled, feeling her breath charged as if with exhaustion. There was none of the pleasure she had heard spoken of, but there was something greater than pleasure, a vast triumph. For the spell was heavy around them both, and she had his spirit and soul and essence. She felt with her hands his sperm that had mingled with the blood of her virginity at the very moment of the moon's turning. She took it on her fingers and marked his brow, and at the touch the spell came on him, and he sat up, slack and lifeless. "Kevin," she said, "get to your horse and ride." He rose, his movements leaden. He turned toward the horse, and she knew that with this spell she must be precise. "Garb yourself first," she said, and mechanically he drew on his robe, tying it about his waist. He moved stiffly, and by starlight she saw the gleam of his eyes. He knew, now, behind the domination of the spell, that she had betrayed him. Her throat tightened with agony and a wild tenderness. She wanted to pull him down again and take away the spell and cover his broken face with kisses and weep for the betrayal of their love. "But I too am sworn, and it is fate." She covered herself with her robe and took her horse, and they rode silently away, taking the road to Avalon. At dawn, Morgaine would have the boat waiting for them on the shore. Some hours before dawn, Morgaine waked from restless sleep, sensing that Nimue's work was done. Silently she robed herself, waking Ninian and the attendant priestesses, who came slowly in her train down to the shore, wrapped in their dark robes and spotted deerskin tunics, hair braided in the single braid down their backs, and the black-handled sickle knives tied at their waists. They waited, silent, Ninian and Morgaine at their head, and as the sky began to flush pale pink with the first light, She motioned to the barge to cast off and watched it disappear in the mists. They waited. The light strengthened, and just as the sun was rising, the boat appeared out of the mists again. Morgaine could see Nimue standing in the prow of the boat, her cloak pulled over her head, tall and straight. But her face was hidden in the darkness of the cloak. There was a slumped heap in the bottom of the boat. What has she done to him? Is he dead, or enspelled? Morgaine found herself wishing that indeed he was dead, and that he had taken his life in despair or terror. Twice she had raged at this man and called him traitor to Avalon, and the third time he had truly been traitor beyond question, taking the holy regalia forth from their hiding place. Oh, yes, he deserved death, even such a death as he should this morning die. She had spoken with the druids, and they had agreed, one and all, that he should die in the oak grove, and that he shouldn't die the swift death of mercy. Treachery of this sort had not been known in all of Britain since the days of Ilan, who had secretly married a son of the Roman proconsul, and had put forth pretended oracles to keep the tribes from rising against the Romans. Ilan had died in the fire, and three of her priestesses with her. And Kevin's deed was not treachery alone, but blasphemy, as when Ilan had meddled with the voice of the goddess. And it must be punished. Two of the barge crew helped the Merlin to his feet. He was half-clad, his robe loosely tied around him, barely concealing his nakedness. His hair was dishevelled, his face blank. Drugged or enchanted? He tried to walk, but without his sticks he reeled and caught for balance at the nearest support. Nimue stood frozen, not looking at him, her face still hidden in her cloak. But as the first rays of the sun arose, she put back the hood, and at that moment, touched by the first sunlight, the enchantment slid off Kevin's face, and Morgaine saw startled comprehension come into his eyes. He knew where he was and what had happened. Morgaine saw him look at Nimue, blinking at the sight of the Avalon barge. And then, all at once, the whole knowledge of his betrayal came over his face, and he lowered his head in shock and shame. So now he knows not only what it is to betray, but to be betrayed. But then she looked at Nimue. The girl was pale, her face bloodless, her long hair in disarray, though she had hastily tried to braid it. Nimue was looking at Kevin, and her lips trembled as she hastily turned her eyes away again. She loved him, too. The spell rebounded on her. I should have known, Morgaine thought, that so powerful a spell would have rebounded on its maker. But Nimue bowed low, as Avalon custom demanded. Lady and mother, she said, her voice toneless, I have brought you the traitor who betrayed the holy regalia. Morgaine stepped forward and embraced the girl, who shrank from the embrace. She said, Welcome back to us, Nimue, priestess, sister, and kissed the girl on her wet cheek. She could feel Nimue's misery through her whole body. Oh, goddess, has this destroyed her too? If so, we have bought Kevin's life at too dear a price. Go now, Nimue, she added in compassion. Let them take you back to the House of Maidens. Your work is done. You need not witness what must come after this. You have done your part, and you have suffered enough. Nimue whispered, What will become of him? Morgaine held her tight. Child, child, that need concern you not. You have done your part with strength and courage. It is enough. Nimue caught her breath as if she would weep, but she didn't. She looked at Kevin, but he didn't meet her eyes, and at last, shivering so hard she could hardly walk, she let two of the priestesses lead her away. Morgaine said in a low voice to them, Don't torment her with questions. Done is done. Let her be. When Nimue was gone, Morgaine turned back to Kevin. She met his eyes, and pain struck at her. This man had been her lover, but he had been more. He had been the only man who had never sought to entangle her in any political manoeuvres, never sought to use her birth or high position, never asked anything of her save love. He had called her alive out of hell in Tintagel. He had come to her as the god. He had been, perhaps, her only friend, man or woman, in her entire life. She forced her words through the tremendous pain in her throat. "Well, Kevin Harper, false Merlin, forsworn messenger, have you anything to say to her before you meet her judgment?"
Kevin shook his head.
"Nothing that you would consider important, Lady of the Lake."
She remembered through a haze of pain that he had been the first to yield to her this title.
"Be it so," she said,
and felt her face like stone. "Take him forth to judgment." He took a single faltering step between his captors, then turned back and faced her, his head thrown back in defiance.
"No, wait," he said. "I find I have a thing to say to you after all, Morgaine of Avalon. I told you once that my life was a small thing to forfeit for the goddess, and I want you to know it is for her that I have done this."
"Are you saying it is for the sake of the goddess that you betrayed the holy regalia into the hands of the priests?"
Ninian demanded, and her voice cut with scorn.
"Why, then, you are mad as well as forsworn. Take the traitor away," she commanded.
But Morgaine signalled to them to wait. "Let him be heard."
"It is even so," said Kevin. "Lady, I said it once to you before this. The day of Avalon is ended. The Nazarene has conquered, and we must go into the mists further and further, until we are no more than a legend and a dream. Would you then take the holy regalia with you into that darkness, preserving it carefully against the dawning of a new day that now shall never be? Even if Avalon must perish, I felt it right that the holy thing should be sent forth into the world in the service of the divine, by whatever name God or the gods may be called. And because of what I have done, the goddess has manifested herself at least once in the world yonder, in a way that shall never be forgotten. The passing of the Grail shall be remembered, my Morgaine, when you and I are only legends for the fireside and tales for the children. I do not think that wasted, nor should you, who bore that chalice as her priestess. Now, do with me what you will." Morgaine bent her head. The memory of that moment of ecstasy and revelation, when she had borne the Grail in the form of the goddess, would remain with her until her death. And of those who had experienced the vision, whatever they might have seen, none of their lives would ever be the same. But now she must face Kevin in the person of the avenging goddess, the death crone, the ravening sow who will devour her own young, the great raven, the destroyer. Yet he had given the goddess this much. She reached out her hand to him and stopped, for under her hand again she saw what once before she had seen, a skull beneath her fingers. "Now he is Fay. He sees his own death, and I see it too. Yet he shall not suffer nor be tortured. He spoke truth. He has done what the goddess has given him to do, and now must I do the same." She waited until her voice was steady before she spoke. In the distance she heard a soft thundering. At last she said, "The goddess is merciful. Take him to the oak grove, as is ordained, but there slay him swiftly with a single stroke. Bury him beneath the great oak, and let it henceforth be shunned now and for ever by all men. Kevin, last of the messengers of the goddess, I curse you to forget all,
to be reborn without priesthood and without enlightenment, that all you have done in your former lives be wiped away, and your soul return to the once-born. 100 lifetimes shall you return, Kevin Harper, always seeking the goddess and never finding her. Yet in the end, Kevin, once Merlin, I say to you, if she wants you, be very sure she will find you again. Kevin looked straight at her. He smiled, that curious, sweet smile, and said, almost in a whisper, "Farewell, then, Lady of the Lake. Tell Nimue I loved her. Or it may be that I will tell her myself. For I think it will be a long, long time before you and I shall meet again, Morgaine." And again, soft thunder punctuated his words. Morgaine shivered as he limped away without looking back, supported on the arms of his captors. "Why do I feel so shamed? I showed mercy. I could have had him tortured. They will call me, too, traitor and weakling, that he wasn't taken to the oak grove and there made to scream and pray for death till the very trees shrank from the sound. Am I only a weakling that I would not torture a man I once loved? Is his death to be so easy that the goddess will then seek vengeance on me? So be it. Even if I must meet the death I could not give him." She flinched, looking into the grey storm clouds in the sky. "Kevin has suffered all his life long. I will add nothing more than death to his fate." Lightning flared in the sky, and she thought, with a shiver, or was it only the cold wind that came with the sudden rush of the storm outside? "So passes the last of the great Merlins into the storm that breaks now over Avalon." She gestured to Ninian. "Go, see my sentence done to the letter, that they slay him with a single stroke, and leave not his body above ground for a single hour." She saw the younger woman's gaze rest on her face. Was it known then to everyone that once they had been lovers? But Ninian only asked, "And you?" "I go now to Nimue. She will need me." But Nimue wasn't in her room in the House of Maidens, nor anywhere in the house. Nor, when Morgaine hurried across the rain-swept courts, was she in the secluded house where she had dwelt with Raven. She wasn't anywhere in the temple, and one of the attendant priestesses told Morgaine that Nimue had refused food or wine, or even a bath. Morgaine, terrible apprehension growing in her with every flash of lightning as the storm grew and raged, called for all the servants of the temple to search for her. But before they could, Ninian came, her face white, attended by the men she had sent to see Kevin's death done, as Morgaine had decreed. "What is it?" Morgaine demanded, her voice cold. "Why was my sentence not done?"
"He was slain with a single stroke, Lady of the Lake," Ninian whispered. "But with the very stroke came lightning from the sky and struck the great oak, cleft it in twain. There is a great rift in the sacred oak, from the sky to the ground." Morgaine felt steel clamp around her throat. "Nothing so strange that with the storm should come the lightning flash, and ever the lightning strikes at the highest point. But that it should come in the same hour wherein Kevin prophesied the end of Avalon." She shivered again, wrapping her arms about herself under her cloak, so that those who looked on her shouldn't see her trembling. How could she turn this omen, for omen it surely was, aside from the impending destruction of Avalon? "The god has prepared a place for the traitor. Bury him, then, within the cleft in the oak." They bowed acquiescence, and went away through thunder and the sudden rattle of rain. And Morgaine, distraught, realized that she had forgotten Nimue.
But a voice within her said, "Now it is too late."
They found her at high noon, just as the sun came out after the storm, floating among the reeds of the lake. Her long hair was spread out on the surface like water weeds, and Morgaine, stunned with grief, couldn't find it in her heart to regret that Kevin had not gone alone into the shadowed land beyond death.
Chapter 12.
Morgaine thought often, in the bleak days which followed upon Kevin's death, now indeed the goddess had taken it upon herself to destroy the companions of the Round Table. But why had it been her will to destroy Avalon too?
"I am growing old. Raven is dead, and Nimue is dead, who should have been lady after me.
And the goddess has laid her hand upon no other to be her prophetess. Kevin lies entombed within the oak. What of Avalon now?" It seemed that the world was shifting, that beyond the mists the world moved at an ever-accelerating pace. No one save herself and one or two of the oldest priestesses could open the gateway through the mists, and there was now little reason to try. And there were times when she walked abroad and could see neither sun nor moon, and she knew that she had strayed over the borders of the fairy country. But she saw only the rarest glimpses of the fairy folk among the trees, nor did she ever again have sight of the queen. She wondered if indeed the goddess had deserted them, for some of the maidens from the House of Maidens had gone again into the world, and others strayed into the fairy country and didn't return again. The goddess came forth for the last time into the world when she bore the Grail through Arthur's Hall at Camelot, Morgaine thought, and then, confused, she asked herself whether the goddess had truly borne the Grail, or had it only been herself and Raven working illusion. "I have called on the goddess and found her within myself." And Morgaine knew that never again would she have the ability to seek beyond herself for comfort or counsel. She could look only within. No priestess, no prophetess, no druid or counsellor, no goddess now to turn to, none but her unguided self. Now and again, when, as the habit of a lifetime bade her, she sought to call up the image of the goddess to guide her, she saw nothing. Or sometimes the face of Ygraine, not the elderly, priest-ridden wife and widow of Uther, but the young and beautiful mother who had first laid these burdens on her, who had bidden her care for Arthur, and given her into the hands of Vivian. And now and again she would see the face of Vivian, who had sent her to the bed of the Horned One, or Raven, who had stood at her side during that great moment of invocation. "They are the goddess, and I am the goddess, and there is no other." She cared little to look into her magical mirror, but now and again, when the moon was dark, she went to drink of the spring and to look into the waters. But she saw only tantalizing glimpses. The companions of the Round Table rode this way and that, following dreams and glimmers of vision and the sight, but none found the true Grail. Some forgot the quest and rode openly in search of adventure. Some met with more of adventure than they could manage, and so died. Some did good deeds, and some evil. One or two, in piercing visions of faith, dreamed their own Grail, and so died. Others, following the message of their own visions, went on pilgrimage to the Holy Lands. And others, still, following a wind that was blowing all through the world in these days, withdrew into solitude and the hermit life, seeking, in crude caves and shelters, the life of silence and penitence. But what visions came to them, whether of the Grail or of some other thing, Morgaine never knew, nor cared. Once or twice she had glimpses of a face she knew. She saw Mordred at Camelot, at Arthur's side. Galahad, too, she saw as he sought the Grail. But then she saw him no more, and wondered if the quest had claimed him to death. And once she saw Lancelot,
half-naked, clad in animal skins, his hair long and ragged, without armour or sword, running in the forest, and the gleam of madness was in his eyes. Well, she had guessed that this quest might lead him only to madness and despair. Still, she sought him again in the mirror, from moon to moon, but for a long time she had no success. Then she saw him sleeping, ragged and naked, on straw somewhere, and the walls of a prison or dungeon rose about him. And then she saw him no more. Oh, gods, has he gone too, with so many of Arthur's men? Truly the Grail was no blessing to Arthur's court, but a curse. And rightly so, a curse to the traitor who would have profaned it. And now is it gone for ever from Avalon? For a long time Morgaine believed that the Grail had been taken away by the goddess into the realms of the gods, so that mankind might never again profane it, and she was content that it should be so, for it had been defiled with the wine of the Christians, which somehow was blood as well as wine, and she had no notion of how to cleanse it. Whispers came from the outside world to Morgaine through some of the old brotherhood of priests, who came in these days to Avalon, Christians some of them, of the old ones who had once worshipped beside the Druids, in their firm belief that their Christ had once lived here on Avalon, and been taught wisdom. Now, fleeing from the enforced conformity of that new breed of Christians who would wipe out all other worship but their own, they came to Avalon, and from them Morgaine heard something of the Grail. The priests were now saying that it was indeed the true cup from which Christ had drunk at his Last Supper, and that it had been taken away into heaven, whence it would never again be seen in the world. Yet also there were rumours that it had been seen on that other isle, Inniswittran, sparkling in the depths of their well, that well which on Avalon was the holy mirror of the goddess, and therefore the priests on Inniswittran had begun to call it the Well of the Chalice. And when the old priests had dwelt for a time upon Avalon, Morgaine began to hear rumours that now and again the Grail had been seen, for a moment, upon their altar. That must be as the goddess wills. They will not profane it. But she knew not whether it was truly there in the ancient church of the Christian Brotherhood, which was built on the very spot of the church on the other island, so that they said that when the mists thinned, the ancient Brotherhood on Avalon could hear the monks chanting in their church on Inniswittran. Morgaine remembered the day when the mists had thinned to let Guinevere through to Avalon. Time ran strangely now upon Avalon. Morgaine didn't know whether that 12 months and a day to which the knights were vowed had passed or not, and sometimes she thought that indeed years must have passed in the outside world. She thought long on the words Kevin had spoken. The mists are closing on Avalon. And then, one day, she was summoned to the shores of the lake. But she needed no sight to tell her who stood in the barge. Avalon had once been his home, too. Lancelot's hair was all grey now, and his face thin and haggard. But as he stepped from the boat, with only the shadow of his old light-footed grace, she stepped forward and took his hands, and she could see in his face no trace of madness. He looked into her eyes, and suddenly it seemed that she was the Morgaine of the old days, when Avalon was a temple alive with priestesses and druids, and not a solitary land adrift in the mists, with a bare handful of aging priestesses, a few elderly druids, a handful of half-forgotten ancient Christians. "How is it that you are so untouched by time, Morgaine?" he asked her. "All seems changed, even here in Avalon. Look, even the ringstones are hidden in the mists." "Oh, they are still there," Morgaine said, "though some of us would lose our way if we sought them now." And like a pain in her heart, she remembered a day. Oh, it was a lifetime ago, when she and Lancelot had lain together in the shadow of the stones. I think perhaps they will one day go altogether into the mists, and thus never be torn down by human hands, or the winds of time. There are none to worship at them now. Even the Beltane fires are no longer lighted on Avalon. Though I have heard that they keep the old rites still in the wildernesses of North Wales, and in Cornwall. The little people will never let them die while any of them survive. I am surprised that you were able to come here, kinsman. He smiled. And now she could see the traces of pain and grief. Yes, even of madness around his eyes.
Why, I hardly knew it was hither I came, cousin. My memory plays tricks on me now. I was mad, Morgaine. I cast away my sword and lived like an animal in the forests. And then there was a time, I know not how long, that I was confined in a strange dungeon.
I saw it, she whispered. I knew not what it meant.
Nor did I.
Nor do I yet, Lancelot said. I remember very little of that time.
It is God's blessing, I think, that I cannot remember what I might have done. I think it was not the first time. There were times during those years with Elaine that I hardly knew what I did.
But you are well now, she said quickly. Come and breakfast with me, cousin.
It is too early for anything else, for whatever reason you came here.
He followed her, and Morgaine took him into her dwelling. Except for her attendant priestesses, he was the first person who had entered it in years. There was fish from the lake this morning, and she served him with her own hands.
"Oh, this is good," he said,
and ate hungrily. She wondered how long it had been since he had last remembered to eat. His hair was as fastidiously combed as ever. His curly hair, all grey now, and patches of white in his beard, neatly trimmed, and his cloak, though shabby and travel-worn, was neatly brushed and clean. He saw her glance at the cloak and laughed a little.
"In the old days I wouldn't have used this cloak for a saddle-blanket," he said. "I lost cloak and sword and armour. I know not where. It may be that I was robbed of them in some evil adventure, or cast them away in madness. I know only that one day I heard someone speak my name, and it was one of the companions. Lamorack, perhaps, though it's still very hazy in my mind. I was too weak to travel, but though he rode on the next day, I began slowly to remember who I was. They gave me a gown and let me sit to table to eat with my knife, instead of throwing me scraps in a wooden piggin."
His laugh was shaky, nervous.
"Even when I knew not that I was Lancelot, I had still my accursed strength, and I think I had done some of them harm. I think I lost the best part of a year out of my life.
I remember only little things, and the main thought in my mind was never to let them know I was Lancelot, lest I bring shame on the companions or Arthur." He fell silent, and Morgaine guessed at his torment by what he didn't say.
"Well, slowly I grew strong enough to travel, and Lamorack had left money for a horse and goods for me. But most of that year is darkness."
He picked up the remaining bread on his plate and resolutely mopped up the scraps of fish. Morgaine asked him, "What of the quest?"
"What indeed?" "I have heard a little," he said, here and there as I rode in the land. Gawain was the first to return to Camelot."
Morgaine smiled, almost against her will. "He was always fickle, to everything and everyone."
"Except to Arthur," Lancelot said. "He is more loyal to Arthur than any of his dogs." "And I met with Gareth as I rode hither."
Morgaine said, "Dear Gareth,
he is the best of Morgause's sons."
"What said he to you?"
"He said he had had a vision," Lancelot said slowly, "which bade him return to court and do his duty by his king and his lands. and not to delay, loitering about and seeking visions of holy things. And he talked a long time with me, begging me to lay aside the quest of the Grail and return to Camelot with him.
"I'm surprised you did not," Morgaine said. He smiled.
"I'm surprised too, kinswoman, and I've promised to return as soon as I can."
Suddenly, his face grew grave.
"Gareth told me," he said, "that Mordred is always about Arthur now. And when I would not return to court with him, he told me this, that what I could best do for Arthur was to find Galahad and bid him return at once to Avalon, for he mistrusted Mordred and his influence upon Arthur. I'm sorry to speak ill of your son, Morgaine."
Morgaine said, "He told me once that Galahad would not live to rule. Yet he swore to me by an oath I do not think he would dare break, that he would have no hand in his death." Lancelot looked troubled.
"I have seen many evil adventures that may befall on this accursed quest. God grant that I can find Galahad before he falls prey to one of them."
A silence fell between them, while Morgaine thought, "I knew it in my heart. This was why Mordred refused the quest." She realized, quite suddenly, that she had ceased to believe that her son Gwydion, Mordred, would ever now be king from Avalon. She wondered when she had begun to accept that in her heart. Perhaps it had been when Accolon died, and the goddess did not stretch forth her hand to protect her chosen. "Galahad will be king, and he will be a Christian king. And that may well mean that he will kill Gwydion. What of the king stag when the young stag is grown? But if the day of Avalon had ended, perhaps Galahad would take his throne in peace, without the need to kill his rival." Lancelot laid down the remnant of a piece of bread and honey and looked past her at the corner of the room.
"Is that Vivian's harp?"
"Yes," she said. "I left mine at Tintagel. But I suppose it is yours by right of inheritance, if you want it."
"I play no longer, nor do I have any will to make music, Morgaine. By right, it is yours, as are all other things which belong to my mother."
Morgaine recalled words which had cut her to the heart, again a lifetime ago.
"I would that you were not so much like my mother, Morgaine." Now the memory held no pain but warmth.
Vivian was not gone entirely from the world, if something survived in her. He said, stumbling,
"There are now so few of us, so few who recall the old days at Caerleon, even at Camelot."
"Arthur is there," she said, "and Gawain, and Gareth, and Kai, and many more, my dear. And no doubt they ask one another with every day, where is Lancelot? Why are you here and not there?"
"I said, my mind plays me tricks. I hardly knew I came hither," Lancelot said. "Yet now I am here, I should ask. I heard Nimue was here."
And she remembered. She had told him this once when he had thought his daughter at the convent where once Guinevere had been.
"I should ask, what has become of her? Is she well? Does she thrive among the priestesses?"
"I am sorry," Morgaine said.
"It seems I have nothing but ill news for you.
Nimue died a year ago." More than this she would not say. Lancelot knew nothing of the Merlin's betrayal, or of Nimue's last visit to the court. It could only grieve him to know the rest. He asked no questions, only sighed heavily and cast his eyes on the floor. At last he said, without looking up,
"And the baby, little Guinevere, she is married and in Les Britain, and this quest has swallowed Galahad. I never knew any of my children. I never tried to know them. It seemed to me they were all I could give Elaine, and so I left them to her almost entirely, even the boy. I rode for a time with Galahad when first we departed from Camelot, and I knew more of him in the 10 days and nights we rode together than in all the 16 years he had lived.